Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that we can all go to every week when it's movie night. On days like today, when the store is quiet, I get to watch movies and series and talk about them with my friends that work here. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop.
Did you see that thing yesterday on the TV?
How's it, guys?
Hey.
Morning, Russell.
How you guys doing?
Good, dude. How are you doing?
I'm fine.
You sound fine.
No, I'm exhausted.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I'm completely exhausted.
Yeah.
Burning the candle at both ends, as they say. The one end being a lovely, busy, you know, the Bioscope.
Yeah.
The other one being Short Straw in a show that we had to do over the weekend. But we'll get into that.
Yeah.
Welcome to the video store. Thank you for wandering in. Thank you for considering our video store because of all the lovely things that we have on the shelf. This is our Clerks episode. So it's myself, Graham, and Perrin having ourselves a fat chat about the movies and the series that we're watching. G-Force, we're not working. You're an editor.
Correct.
And you're also very much the producer of the show.
Mm.
So we treasure you for that. P-Dog, Perrin.
Yeah.
What do you do with your time?
I'm a editor, videographer, writer, but lately it's mostly been editing to pay the bills.
Lovely.
Yeah.
And then I own the Bioscope, which is an independent cinema here in Johannesburg. And so I'll talk a lot about that. So this is our Clerks chat.
Yes.
Where the three of us get to hang and talk shit. So we should definitely be talking about Beetlejuice.
Yes.
I want to talk about the showerhead, which is the Zapiro doc.
Very cool.
And then we've got to talk about The Perfect Couple,
yes,
which is the big Netflix show that I think all of us binged this last weekend. So we'll get into that.
Nice.
But before we get a little too into it, I just want to make a little announcement for everyone that is browsing the shelves.
Attention all customers. This is just to let you know that our good friends and loyal customers here at the video store, The Universe on Stage, have got two special shows at the Joburg Theatre this weekend. So that's the 13th and the 14th of September. It is a special show called Hidden Giants. So if you go on over to Web Tickets and look for The Universe on Stage or Hidden Giants, you'll see it and you should buy tickets. It is a beautiful talk about space and the universe. So it's effectively a nice, smart science talk that is pitched to everyone with this beautiful musical accompaniment. And so, yeah, The Universe on Stage, Hidden Giants, this weekend.
Cool.
Yeah, it's going to be great. I'm so excited for them. And they've asked me to introduce the shows.
Yes, that's very cool.
And I'm going to be helping moderate a bit of a discussion afterwards.
Nice.
And they're selling a load of tickets, but let's get it packed
out. That's cool. Yeah, definitely.
So it's going to be a good show.
Rad.
And it's nice to kick off with a little, hey, did you guys see?
Yeah.
And so that's always a good chance to talk about the current news.
Mm.
So, who wants to kick it off?
I can kick us off.
All right.
Hey, have you guys heard of a movie called Better Man?
I feel like
it's... Is it an older movie?
No. This is a movie that's not out yet.
Oh, wait. Did we... No. I think we spoke about it with the face dysmorphia.
No. This is something else. I'm going to read you an excerpt from a review for this. So, it's been screening at... at festivals and such.
Yeah.
This is actually David Ehrlich's review. We've spoken about him before. But the other thing that sets Better Man apart from the rest of its ilk, and this might be too subtle for some people to notice, is that Robbie Williams is played by a computer-generated monkey for the entire film. So this is a Robbie Williams biopic, if you prefer.
Yeah.
But a monkey plays him.
Where Robbie Williams is a monkey. And it's actually Robbie Williams in the role.
Did Ehrlich give it a good review?
I think he gave it like a 3.5.
Okay, so like I hate their letter system. So that's like a 3.5 is like a B plus.
Yeah, I would think something like
that. Yeah.
Yes.
But that sounds awesome.
It sounds like what a great idea.
Yeah, do you know what I love about these recent flurries of biopics? Is they're trying to be different.
Yes.
So like the Pharrell Williams Lego one.
Yes.
Is a cool one.
Yeah. It's a bizarre thing.
Yeah.
And
it's inventive. It's so cool.
Yeah. So Piece by Piece is coming out soon.
Mm, yeah.
It's going to come out mid-October.
Yeah.
And it's one of those films that I've identified for the Bioscope, but I've said to the distributors, like, what kind of a movie is it?
Yeah. Like, who's it for?
Because the moment you make it a Lego movie,
yes,
like Lego specifically, there's got to be like a family element to it. It's got to tick boxes. If it's just computer generated animated monkey, it could be the naughtiest, most depraved monkey.
Yeah. Yeah,
but the moment it's Lego, there's got to be a sheen of perfection and boxes ticked.
Yeah, like the most recent biopic that I absolutely loved, music biopic, was the Weird Al Yankovic
one. Oh, I still haven't seen
that. It's so good. Like, you know, he's the master of parodying songs and stuff.
Exactly.
The movie is a parody of a biopic. Nice. So, like, I think there's only one element in that movie that is actually true. And that's literally that an accordion salesman, door-to-door accordion salesman, sold them an accordion. Everything else is, like, false.
Completely,
like, there's a love
amazing
affair with Madonna.
Yeah.
He performs for Pablo Escobar.
Yeah,
there's one of my favorite lines in the whole movie is that he has to go work with his dad at the factory, and then he gets to the factory, he's like, "What do we actually make? I don't know. It's the factory."
and how everyone was jealous of the Weird Al Yankovic bump.
Yeah.
Where if your song gets parodied.
Yeah, Michael Jackson's Bad is
a parody of his song. Yeah, yeah. No, it's
so good.
Okay, lovely. But we don't know much about.
No, there isn't even like a trailer or anything for it yet.
Is it an approved biopic by Robbie Williams?
Robbie Williams is playing the role of Robbie Williams
as a monkey.
Yes.
Awesome.
It's so bizarre.
It's so
cool. Dig Robbie Williams, man. He's
cool. It sounds, and it's, hang on, it's the guy who directed, The Greatest Showman.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, weird. That's such a bizarre series of choices. Strange. Okay, should I go?
Yeah.
Okay, did you guys see that Michelle Gondry and talking about Pharrell Williams, is they doing a musical together? So this should be... This should be Michelle Gondry's first film in a while, like a long, long time. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there, because I know he disappeared for a little while. He did a TV show with Jim Carrey.
Yes.
Yeah.
But he's been kind of under the radar, especially after, like, when Jim Carrey talked about how Michelle Gondry spoke to him with Eternal Sunshine. Did you hear about that?
No.
So, like...
Would you know that I had firsthand contact
I know you did.
With
yeah.
Michelle Gondry?
Yeah, yeah.
You've spoken about
so,
that.
So, like, with Michelle Gondry, there was one thing that Jim Carrey... Because, you know, Jim Carrey's very jaded with the industry, right?
Yes.
So, like, one of the things that he said that, like, stood out for him, and it sucks because Eternal Sunshine is such a great movie, and also I get why Michelle Gondry did this, because he's, you know, and a creative. But, like, he said to him... your sadness is so beautiful. Use that. Like, it was along the lines of that. Like, he was basically saying, like, don't get better. You need to stay depressed because it's beautiful for the film.
Okay.
And Jim Carrey thought that was, like, gross. And it is gross.
Yeah. Right.
And I get it was Michel Gondry being a director, but...
Gondry is a very famous French director. He started in music videos doing Bjork and Chemical Brothers and Daft Punk, the famous Around the World music video.
Oh, so good.
A lot of White Stripe stuff. Then he ventured into film and got going and really had a very promising career.
Yeah.
Making gems like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Be Kind Rewind, and then he kind of lost his mind.
I think Green Hornet destroyed his brain.
It was too compromised because it was this big budget Hollywood movie.
It was like $100 million superhero.
And it didn't really
movie.
Have his unique stamp on it.
At all.
I think he probably felt quite compromised at that point.
Yeah, 100%.
But then we were gonna have him come to South Africa for a Bioscope exhibition. It was his exhibition called The Home Movie Factory.
Yes.
And anyone who knows the Bioscope for a long time, this was something we were planning back in 2012.
Mm.
And it was based off Be Kind Rewind, where you use props and cheap ideas and special effects.
Yeah.
You know, these kind of very practical special effects to remake movies. And he was busy trying to adapt a very famous French book at the time, with two very famous French actors, one of which was the woman from Amélie.
Mm. Okay.
And he kind of lost his mind. And and 2 weeks out of his visit, the woman we dealt with the most, which was his assistant, phoned to say, he's not coming.
Yeah.
Shit.
And I've quit.
Damn.
Jeez. He's like effectively lost his mind. He got... it sounded like he was getting very angry and there was... I don't want to put anything out there too specific, but it sounded like she just did not want to work with him anymore. But she was like, I love you guys and I love what you're doing and I really love the Home Movie Factory as an idea.
Mm.
So I'm going to come out and just make sure that it gets
done. Yeah.
And and then we sort of, it was a bit of this anti-climax because he was a bit of a hero for us.
Yes.
Yeah. Like the thing with Michel Gondry, you look at his career going forward. I mean, I didn't watch the Jim Carrey show, but I heard it was a return to form for him.
Okay.
I started it, but nothing kind of hooked me.
Yeah. So but it was a return to form in terms of that trademark Michel Gondry creativity. You know what I mean?
Right.
Where he moving, yeah.
Yeah, find the movie Science of Sleep.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is also just a perfect example
well.
Of using cellophane as an ocean.
Yeah, he's got a very DIY style to his work, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that's what the Be Kind Rewind was essentially the mantra of Michel Gondry. But like if you look at his films, Eternal Sunshine is easily his best film, at least for me. But every film he made after that, you could see that his style started to take steps back because he had so much pressure to live up to.
Mm.
And he started doing these bigger studio pictures and
they
just sucked the fun out of it.
Yeah.
You know?
But yeah, speaking of Eternal Sunshine, where they were, that island, that like Montauk kind of New England is something I want to... This is foreshadowing for later. We want to talk about the perfect couple.
That's where it's set. That was a very good segue.
It's set in that part of the world, but in more of the summertime. You know, summer.
Yeah.
Eternal Sunshine, they go to that place in winter.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. I got one here. Mm. The Holdovers.
Yes.
Which is the
Christmas movie.
The Oscar... That could be a nice Christmas movie.
It's a Christmas movie.
Yeah, I didn't think of it as that. But it was a little Oscar darling earlier this year. The Bioscope screened it, but I think it largely got a little lost in all the chaos. It's coming to Showmax.
Nice.
Such a goodie.
From the 16th of September.
Okay,
it's definitely worth your time. And it perhaps is more of a couch movie.
Yeah.
Because it's a little sort of... I don't know how to pronounce it, but like a sort of event.
It's a buddy movie.
It's a buddy comedy.
Yeah, it's like an odd couple-esque movie, you know, like these people from different odds and ends getting together to spend the holidays together, you know, and it's going to be added to my Christmas watch list Christmas time. Die Hard, The Holdovers. Yeah. Perfect pairing.
Hey, did you guys see the trailer for Wolfman?
No.
It looks pretty freaking cool. So a few years ago, Lee Winnell, who's the guy who created Saw and Insidious, I think, as well.
He's Australian.
He's an Aussie. He did a remake of The Invisible Man.
I enjoyed that.
Which I haven't actually seen it, but I've heard it's good.
Bloody good.
Now he's taking a crack at Wolfman.
Okay, but this isn't anything to do with Universal wanting to do their dark universe.
I think it is.
Because they did give that a crack on a huge...
Although I don't know if it's Universal. Yeah, that whole dark universe
thing. Yeah, they did
it
with The Mummy
thing.
And they did it with Benicio del Toro in his Wolfman.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's related to that, but the fact that it's the same director who did the previous thing, who is also part of that whole thing.
Yeah, Invisible Man's fantastic.
Yeah, I've heard it's very good. I really want to see it.
Wait, so is this the Benicio del Toro?
No, The Invisible Man's with Elizabeth Moss from Handmaid's Tale.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a sort of better Hollow Man.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, way better Hollow Man. Yeah, like the whole... idea of that movie is about like domestic violence and the trauma of it, and
it becomes something
so
more.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's
using
so
this device to make a commentary on that.
Yeah, it's very, very clever film. Yeah.
So this is from Blumhouse. So I assume these characters are all public domain now.
Yeah,
so they're obviously trying to do their own, like, since Universal failed and they couldn't do it.
Yeah,
they're obviously going, no, we can do it. We'll do it better than Universal.
So that's one thing that I'm dreading about all these public domain lifting things is all these bad horror movies.
Yeah,
that are
it's
coming
like Winnie
out.
The Pooh horror
so,
movies.
So at least Blumhouse, yeah, exactly. At least Blumhouse has a little bit of prestige on it.
Yes.
You know what I mean? With Winnie the Pooh with Blood and Honey is just awful. Now they're doing a Peter Pan horror movie. It's just going to get... They're going to do a Mickey Mouse
They're doing a Steamboat Willie
horror movie. I swear they wrote it a year in advance waiting for it. Or they wrote it the night before.
Yeah.
One of the two. Probably the day of.
Yeah.
I think there's a Bambi one coming out
as God.
Well.
They just aren't like, telling now. They're flooding it through ChatGPT.
Yeah.
Mm.
But the idea is that after a certain amount of time,
Yeah.
certain things become public domain, meaning you can use them. So like the Winnie the Pooh, for example, what's become public domain is the character from the book, but not necessarily Disney's Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah.
So Disney's Winnie the Pooh looks different, right?
Yeah.
He's got like He's a red shirt or something.
Yeah.
So it's like the red shirt Winnie the Pooh is not available, but Winnie the Pooh is available for you to kind of desecrate. And it just, maybe it's a, you know, maybe it's a great testament to humans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That the moment Winnie the Pooh becomes available, it's like, you don't make this sweet, beautiful Winnie the Pooh movie because you can. You make a fucking horror movie.
Yeah.
But the thing is, the problem with the Blood and Honey movies, if you're going to make a Z-grade horror movie, at least make it so bad that it's good.
Right.
The problem with that movie is it's so bad that it's bad. It's just boring.
Oh, so you've actually seen it?
I gave up.
Okay.
I started and I was like, oh my God, I can't.
But Disney's played a big part in like changing the laws around like that sort of thing to keep, specifically to keep Mickey Mouse copyrighted.
Yeah, because that's very protected. And so Steamboat Willie, which was the first version of...
That's public domain.
Yes.
Of Mickey Mouse.
So that version
Steamboat
of...
Steamboat Mickey, sorry.
Yeah. No, it's called Steamboat Willie.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Well, was that his original name?
No. Steamboat, the steamboat is named Willie. It's Steamboat Willie, But that specific version of Mickey Mouse is now public domain.
Yeah.
But the normal, like regular, every other version of him is still copyrighted.
Yeah.
Hectic.
It's like, it's wild that it can be that specific.
It's so nuts. Jesus.
Do we have any more?
Did you see that Venice wrapped up and Nicole Kidman won Best Actress? Pedro Almodovar won Best Film with his first English language film.
Yes. That's got a release date. It's early next year.
But I'm surprised that that won because the critics were a bit mixed about it.
Okay.
What's the name of that film?
It is called, I'll tell you now.
So this is Pedro Almodovar.
It's called like My Neighbor or something. Yeah, Pedro Almodovar.
Who is a very famous Spanish director.
Yeah.
Who did... a host of movies.
Yeah, All About My Mother.
Talk to Her.
Bad Education. Yeah.
Okay.
And is this really his first English movie?
Yeah. He did a short film with...
Ethan Hawke and
He did one with Tilda Swinton. That was his first like English language foray. And then he did a Western, a queer Western with Ethan Hawke and Pedro Pascal, which was a missed opportunity in my opinion.
Yeah.
The latest one is with... Julianne Moore and Tilda Swinton.
Okay.
Tilda Swinton looks particularly Tilda Swinton.
Yeah.
She looks like literally
Tilda
like
on crack.
The ghost of herself. Because she can sometimes look sort of, you know, quite modelly beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah.
But very famously can be quite skeletal.
Yeah.
And in this movie, she looks like the ghost of Tilda Swinton.
The ghost of Tilda Swinton.
While you're Googling the name of this Almodovar film, what did Nicole Kidman win? For
Baby Girl, I think that's what it's called. It's basically almost like a she has a relationship with a coworker, a younger, much younger coworker, and it's like the dynamic of that.
Okay,
but she couldn't collect the award. The director had to because her mom suddenly passed away, so she had to leave.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. Well, speaking of sudden deaths around Nicole
Kidman,
The
Room Next Door is the name of the movie. It's coming soon.
The Room Next Door. Yeah, there is a release date for it. They're looking at early next year for South Africa.
Okay.
So that's exciting, especially when it wins at Venice.
Yes.
And these festival wins really give these films a big boost. But speaking of sudden deaths around Nicole Kidman, another beautiful foreshadow to what we're going to talk about later, which is The Perfect Couple on Netflix.
Sick.
I'm going to try to find every little segue I've got to do that.
Awesome.
Speaking of festival wins, hey, did you guys see Alana?
Yes.
The film that won at Cannes.
Oh, Anora.
Anora.
Yeah.
It's going to come to the Bioscope and cinemas in early November.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm very excited about that. Sean Baker is one of my filmmaking, I just adore everything he's done. Red Rocket. If you haven't seen it, Simon Rex should have been nominated for an Academy Award for that. It's so good. It's about a washed out porn star who returns back to his hometown to start again, and he's just the most despicable person. But his performance is so good that you love to hate him and you hate to love him.
Right. This is a film called Red Rocket.
Red Rocket. It came
out, which I don't think is anywhere in South Africa.
I think it's streaming somewhere, but it's so good. A24 distributed it, so
okay,
it's got to be somewhere.
But Anora looks amazing.
Oh, so good.
It won at Cannes. It won the Palme d'Or, which is the big prize at Cannes.
Yeah.
It's an English language film, an American girl who meets a Russian guy.
Yeah, she's a cool girl.
She's a call girl, and they elope
sort
of quite quickly, and then the mess of where this Russian guy's money comes from comes to haunt her.
Okay, Red Rocket is over on Apple TV.
Oh, cool! Yeah, it's fantastic. Okay. He did Florida Project, which is probably his most well-known.
Okay, that was it. Right,
but he's very almost like he's like, I'd say he's the leader of American neorealism at this point, which
American neorealism.
Yeah,
I remember studying Italian neorealism.
Yeah.
At film school. But that's the sort of idea of recreating a more realistic world in your style of cinema, as opposed to, you know, the Wes Anderson, which is the complete opposite. Which
is exactly,
a very stylized, fantastical. Mm. This is them trying to kind of create as a real life picture as possible. Yeah, yeah. So your camera is very much a fly on the wall.
Mm. The biggest examples of his filmography that taps into that ethos is Florida Project and Tangerine, which was shot on an iPhone, and it's about trans prostitutes in LA. It's a comedy. It's hysterical. It's set in one day. And it's so good. It's so funny.
Okay.
Yeah.
Should we get on to films?
Yeah. Let's do it.
Let's talk about Beetlejuice.
Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice.
Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice.
Yeah. You've said it like five times.
We're fucked now.
Yeah.
Very famous Tim Burton film from the late 80s, Beetlejuice, got itself a long-awaited sequel where pretty much everyone involved returns 20 years later for the sequel. Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, which is now in cinemas. The Bioscope saw a sold-out weekend.
Nice.
Which was delightful.
Yeah.
And it was just so fun to do that. And we also did the original on one or two occasions in our program. So it was a nice refresher, because a little bit like Top Gun, it was a while ago.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so for you, Perrin, I think perhaps you can lead the discussion on what you think about it.
So we rewatched it the night before, the first one, before watching the movie at the movies. And I liked Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. I thought it was great fun. It did exactly what it needed to do on the tin. It's not as good as the original, but it was great fun. The only aspects I didn't really... Oh, let me talk about what it's about.
Yeah, sure. So I think...
So the original Beetlejuice, right? So the whole premise is that Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis, they have a house. They have this beautiful house in the countryside. They suddenly die and they become ghosts. Then a new family moves in, but one's this eccentric artist and the other is more homely father and stuff like that. But they want to make big changes to the house and they hate this idea. So they want them out. So they try to haunt them, try to scare them away, but they kind of like it because they're not scaring them. They think it's like a great thrill ride, like a haunted house thing. But the only people that can see them properly is Winona Ryder, their daughter. She decides to try to help them either live together or get them out of the house. But because nothing's working, this couple then go to the underworld and seek out a guy named Beetlejuice, who's a demon, who can promises to exorcise the house to get rid of this new couple that's moved in.
And at this point, where does one even get the name Beetlejuice?
Like,
where does this even come from? Do we know?
So I know this
is... it's a bizarre... thing to choose.
The one thing I didn't really figure out why. Yeah. So in the movie, the original one, they call him Beetlegeist. Like in the writing and script and all that is Beetlegeist.
Yeah. Like juice spelt with like
G U I S E. So
like disguise.
Yeah.
Like,
so I don't know why.
Which came first, the planet or the movie?
Definitely the planet, I think.
Because there's a planet called Beetlejuice.
Yeah. So that's.
Oh, no. This is what I'm interested in. Yeah. Okay. So there's a planet.
Yes. Yeah. There's a planet called. But spelt like that, but that way with a G.
Yeah.
It's mentioned in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah.
A fictitious planet.
No. It's a real planet.
Yeah.
But they've just. One of the planets they've like identified.
Is it a star or a planet? It's one of the two.
You might be right.
It's a heavenly body. Yeah. That's all we know. So anyways, right? So yeah, so they, it's a whole series of events, but now one of the deals that Beetlejuice wants is that he wants to marry Winona Ryder. That's part of the deal. And if he gets to marry a human, that means he gets to cause more chaos in the mortal world.
Yeah, and he's this kind of
weird... He's a chaotic demon.
Chaotic character. You know, we all know the image of Michael Keaton as Beetlejuice in this kind of black and white striped shirt. Yeah. Crazy sort of like rotting body.
Yeah.
Very white skin with these sort of dark, almost like panda bear
eyes. Yeah.
And then, of course, he can do things and transform himself and appear and everything. And it's a hit.
It's a cult classic. Movie, yeah.
Okay, so now we're in the next generation with Beetlejuice. Yeah. Mm. We have the dad of the eccentric artist who's now passed away.
Yeah.
But now Winona Ryder, who's now no longer a young sort of teenager.
Yeah, she's like a medium on TV, and
she's now an established medium on like television. She's like a sort of crossing over with Gareth or whatever that guy's name was that had a TV show, but quite famous, like a sort of a Dr. Phil kind of daytime TV person that everyone seems to know. But she's got a daughter now, played by Jenna Ortega, who has to be in your sort of gothic supernatural franchise.
She's built for Tim Burton.
Because she's the it girl, but made famous recently by the Netflix TV show Wednesday, which was also very much a sort of Burton-esque production. So she's now a classic teenage girl, but they are dealing with the death of the grandfather and what happens.
So, essentially what happens is, they...
Well, we also don't want to give too much away, but the idea is that we venture back into the underworld here.
Right.
I think we get more of Beetlejuice in this movie.
Yeah, so basically...
Because I think it's one of those things where, obviously, it was what made the original charming, was to have this character, and of course now you kind of want to see more of him in the sequel. So there was a bit more of Beetlejuice, but he was a little different this time around.
Yeah, so also Beetlejuice is starting to appear to Winona Ryder after all these years. So she's like freaking out a bit. She's like worried that he's back, right?
Right.
So at the house, at the old house, Beetlejuice lives in this model set in the basement.
Yeah.
Like he's like there. And now she's worried about him, and by telling her fiancé, who's also her producer on the show, that this guy is around, they say his name 3 times by accident and he appears.
But
he's got his latches back in him. You know?
Yeah, there's another great story, subplot, which people have mentioned makes this movie a little bit more heartfelt.
Yeah, right.
Which is there's a story about Jenna Ortega's character wanting to kind of reach her dad. She also has this kind of love interest entanglement. But we spend a lot of time in the underworld, which makes the
movie
great.
In the underworld, Willem Dafoe's there.
Yeah, Willem Dafoe plays this sort of cop character.
Yeah.
But it's delightful. And it's a very much a return for Tim Burton to that more practical effect.
Lots of practical effects. Not all of it, but a lot of the special effects are practical. Like there's a little Beetlejuice baby, I'm not giving it away, but there's like a Beetlejuice baby that appears and he's like practical, like he's like he's like animatronic doll and stuff like that, and the sandworms are still stop motion animation and stuff like that.
And I think in the general appeal of this movie and everyone on set, they were saying that Tim Burton was excited, and giddy, and happy, and so I think that's a cool thing, and that makes its way through the movie, where it's not banged out,
right?
You know, and Alice in Wonderland, when he did that earlier with Johnny Depp, like it was just filled with so much CGI, and that can make a person feel cold. We've spoken about this often on the show.
Yeah, 100%.
We're just. It can be too much, and it doesn't feel real. Where even if practical effects appear cheesy, like if you go back and watch The Thing and all these other movies, there's still something very tangible about them, and the audience can feel it a bit more. And so
magic.
this had that. Obviously, it still had quite a lot of technology behind it.
Yeah.
But it was very heartfelt, and it just ticked all the boxes. And I feel the same as you, Perrin. It didn't shift the goalpost,
yeah,
but it was such a lovely addition that just stuck the landing.
Nice.
And it's great. And it's just to have it sit alongside the original, I think is great.
Okay.
Yeah, I think one of the only things I thought that it could have done with that was the subplot of Beetlejuice's long lost bride hunting him down.
Okay.
So she wants Beetlejuice back.
Yeah, it was a very
it just felt like
little third subplot.
It felt like, because she's played by Monica Bellucci, who's now married to Tim Burton.
Yes.
And it felt like Tim Burton was like, I need my wife in a movie. And Monica Bellucci is a respected actress.
Yeah, she didn't do much. It didn't go too far. So you, yeah. Or it was the other way around, where she's like, and what's my role going to be? And
he's
like,
exactly. It's like, oh, just look beautiful. You know, you're there. Yeah.
But you were saying something about Beetlejuice. He, in this one, he's less...
Okay, I'm sorry. I don't want to. Lack of a better word, he is less rapey in this one.
Right.
The first movie, he's very like forces himself on all the women, and like he wants to marry an underage girl,
right,
to be his bride. And so this one they've taken that aspect a little way. Still got the Beetlejuice
tenacity,
quote unquote charm, but it's not that.
I just think that's interesting. It's like. Yeah. When you remake it 20 years later, you take out that stuff.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
you look back on that first film and you're like, oh, that's a bit it's a bit aggressive. Yeah.
Which is also why Geoffrey Jones isn't in the sequel.
Yeah.
Who's Geoffrey Jones?
Geoffrey Jones, was the father?
He actually died, didn't he?
I have no idea. But the reason he went to jail for the sort of porn that gets you sent to jail.
Jesus. Oh, God.
So he hasn't been in very many movies.
Is he the dad who then they die? And
oh, no, he's alive.
He's alive in real life. Yes.
Wow.
Okay,
I thought he was dead.
But is he the character who's dead in Beetlejuice?
Yeah.
Beetlejuice?
Yeah.
Oh.
We don't even see his face in the
Yeah.
Yeah, literally, he got eaten by a shark.
Yeah. Oh.
So when you see his character in the underworld,
he's
a big chomp from his chest, and he sort of speaks through his sort of spine with a sort of splattering.
Crazy. I didn't realize he...
Okay, no, this is interesting. Okay, so this character, and you might, if you Google him, you'll recognize his face because he's been in a bunch of movies.
Yeah, he was a famous character actor.
He was Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Yeah, he was the...
He was the principal.
Yeah.
Okay, so he is in jail currently.
Well, no, he went to jail.
He went to jail.
Yes.
He hasn't worked since. He's been blacklisted, yeah.
I wouldn't hire him.
No.
Very interesting. Okay. Good. All right. and on that interesting note, let's talk about the next film.
Okay, cool.
Talk about Napoleon.
I watched the director's cut of Ridley Scott's Napoleon.
Okay.
So they've been speaking about this for a while because the theatrical cut came out about a year ago.
Okay.
And at the time, they were like, we're going to do a director's cut as well.
The theatrical release, which didn't spend too much time in cinemas. It was mostly made for Apple TV.
Yes.
The theatrical cut itself was a good 3 hours.
No, it was about two and a half, 220, something like that.
Okay.
It wasn't actually that long.
It wasn't. Okay. So how long is the director's cut?
About 320.
Okay. More,
it adds probably about 45 minutes.
Okay.
They're originally talking about like a 4 hour cut, but that obviously didn't happen. They you know, wiser heads, obviously.
Yeah. And what did you think of it?
I enjoyed the original cut. I know a lot of people didn't because I think people were expecting, it's coming from Ridley Scott, so people are expecting Gladiator. Instead, he took $200 million and made what is essentially a comedy about what a pathetic loser Napoleon actually was.
Yeah.
You know, and I like that aspect of it. I'm like, don't celebrate this guy.
Yeah, because there's a lot of things about...
He's a horrible person.
Yeah, our memory
of... He's a dictator.
Our memory of Napoleon is so warped.
Yes.
Like, he wasn't that short. And, you know, there's a lot of things that we don't correctly.
That was British propaganda, to say that he was short. Yeah. He was like not the average height of a Frenchman at the time.
Yeah.
And so he was just, how could he be celebrated?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, because, the movie very much portrays him as this very insecure, like very, it's the kind of movie where there are often shots of like people and you can see they're like sniggering a little bit. Or as he turns around to leave a room, they like smile at each other. Like it feels like you're joining in and like laughing at him behind his back. So, which is like my favorite part of that film.
Yeah, so like I know with the one aspect that I didn't like about the original film was the Ridley Scott version.
Yes.
Yeah, is that they didn't make me, because like you said, you don't want to celebrate and you know, glorify a dictator.
Yeah.
But I also want to see why the French revere him so much. At least give me a taste of that.
Yeah, that was what I was trying to ask earlier. What is the argument for why he should be celebrated?
I think because he was so, well, okay, you need to remember when he came to power was just after the French Revolution.
100%, okay. Yeah.
So this was a time when the French, like, population rose up and killed the monarchy, basically. He was like an everyman. He wasn't royalty.
Okay.
So he had risen up through like the military ranks.
Okay.
He was an everyman. Yeah.
Yeah, and but also because and he did lead all these like military victories.
Okay.
You know, and that's sort of
what he gave the French some pride.
Yeah, exactly. And he was heavily involved in that. But he's still kind of, you get to see the way that he took power and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Which is pretty effective. And then I mean, what the film, not to be like, it's not really a spoiler, but you know, a lot of biopics, but a lot of biopics will end with like a text thing of like, this is what happened at this point. And like gives you that, like Napoleon died on this date at this place. But then it starts going, he led like however many battles. And then it shows you like the place of the battle and like 30,000 dead.
Yeah.
This many dead at this place. And it ends on this note of like, Napoleon is responsible for like more than 3 million
deaths
of French soldiers. And it's like, it's kind of going, oh, you, like, this is the point.
Yeah,
like the movie ends on this note of like, okay, I hope you get it now. You know,
okay. Do you like the extended?
I do. Okay, I think I liked it. I like the humor of it. I think Joaquin Phoenix's performance is really good, in terms of like fitting that character of this very like insecure, very pathetic version of Napoleon. You know, I think what Joaquin Phoenix gets is that acting isn't just delivering dialogue. It's about like the physicality, and if you watch him walk, like you watch the way he walks up a flight of stairs,
there's
a performance in that.
Mm.
Like he's making deliberate choices about the way Napoleon moves and everything about that character. Okay. I think it's really effective.
Could he be Oscar nominated next year for it?
No, it came out last year.
Did it come out last year and he didn't? Yeah. Was he nominated?
No, he wasn't.
Okay, I'm just trying to get the timing right.
Yeah.
Of when you qualify and when you don't qualify.
I think the only nomination it got was like production design.
Okay.
That was it. Yeah.
P-Dog, have you got a film?
I watched a new Yorgos Lanthimos movie.
Yorgos Lanthimos.
Yeah. If you miss, so it's written with his writer before The Favourite. So the guy who wrote Dogtooth with him, The Killing of the Sacred Deer.
Okay.
Was like peak Lanthimos weirdness before he got like, I don't want to say commercial because Poor Things and The Favourite are not commercial movies.
But they were more
more mainstream, right?
Yeah.
So this has his original Greek weirdness that we know and love him for.
He's a, so he's a very famous Greek director who's made a host of very celebrated but very weird, very arty films.
No one makes movies like Yorgos.
Yeah.
Like,
and I think he also has his own arrogance in a good way. Like, people who work with him say, you know, are we correct here? Are we doing this? And he's apparently said, like, I'm Yorgos Lanthimos. Yeah. Like, listen to me.
Do you know what I like about Yorgos is he is one of the, his movies are so fucked up all the time. But he's like into like the most normal things. Like, apparently his favorite show ever is Friends, and he's obsessed with it. He knows all the dialogue, all the lines. But anyway, so Kinds of Kindness is an anthology film.
Yeah, so say. So
three stories. They interlink with each other in terms of theme, not necessarily them directly. It's not like a Magnolia where it's like 12 different characters. They link up somehow, you know?
Yeah.
The themes that it links together with all have to do with water, dogs, water, dogs, and like control, like someone controlling people, like lots of free will, essentially.
Right.
So it's so interesting. Jesse Plemons is outstanding. So he won Best Actor at Cannes for this. And he is phenomenal. I'm loving this rise of Plemons taking leading man roles because he's so fucking good. He's not just a Matt Damon lookalike.
I was about to say, Jesse Plemons, so if you don't know who we're talking about, if you squint, he looks a little bit like Matt Damon.
Yes.
Yeah. If you watch Breaking Bad, he was one of the bad guys in the last few seasons. I can't remember his name in it.
Yeah.
But he's the creepy Nazi, neo-Nazi guy that helps Walter and Jesse.
But just a bit more context, Yorgos Lanthimos brought us Poor Things at the start of this year, which was a very celebrated, very awarded film at the Oscars.
Loved it.
Oh. And then quite quickly, it almost felt like too quickly, it was like, surprise, here's another film. But then you realize like it is a smaller production.
Yeah, it's a smaller production. It's essentially the same cast of
Poor Things. And that's why everyone was like, how did you have time to bang this out? And then you remember like a movie like Poor Things probably got shot, you know, such a long time before it eventually made its way to cinema. You know, a film's got a very long life. And so, Kinds of Kindness was a bit of a buzz film this year because it was at Cannes, which was May. Then it's been in some cinemas. It never came to South African cinemas.
Weirdly, because it has Emma Stone in it.
No, but when you start watching it, and so I brought it up in last week's episode saying, I see it's now on Disney Plus.
I want to now
watch it. I hadn't had a chance to watch it. I started watching and I was like, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
It's arty.
Yeah.
this is not a commercial darling.
But it's got that Yorgos Lanthimos like strange humor laced throughout. Like all of his movies always are, even Dogtooth. Dogtooth is fucked up, but there's a weird sense of humor underneath there. Same as Killing of a Sacred Deer.
You need humor.
Yeah.
You need it.
That's one thing that I love about the Coen brothers is that they could have a deadly serious movie like No Country for Old Men, like Blood Simple, but there's always laces of comedy throughout.
Yeah.
You know, because life is like that. Like, no matter how fucked up or horrible life may get, there's always something funny.
Yes.
Even if it is a cruel humor, a cruel joke.
I've said that many times. Poor Things for me, the way I sold it to people in the lobby of the bioscope was like, it's lacquer weird. It is super arty, but it's funny.
Yeah.
It's like, it's fun. It's a fun movie, despite being how weird it is. And I think that also, that levity, is that the word? Mm. Like really helped people go like, okay, I'm keen. Okay.
Yeah, basically, because Poor Things, the original release was last year.
Yeah.
And it was a great counter film to Barbie, you know what I mean? Like it follows the same kind of like, and they mirror each other so well. So like Barbie is for everyone. Yes. Poor Things is like the racier, edgier Barbie. Yeah.
Thinking person's.
Yeah. That was my
academic study.
That was my third favorite movie of last year. So yeah.
Poor Things.
Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah, it only came to South African cinemas at the start of the year.
Yeah. Came late.
But it's based on a book.
Yes.
Yeah.
Poor Things is a book.
Yeah.
It was almost going to be my, hey, did you guys see?
But I think
maybe it was obvious. But for me, when I was in Exclusive Books, I was like, oh, hey, did you guys see Poor Things was a book? All right. Can we move on?
Yeah.
I watched The Showerhead last week. It is a documentary about the cartoonist and satirist Zapiro, who is a national treasure here in South Africa. And it is going to be in selected cinemas from the 13th of September. One of those cinemas is the Bioscope with tickets really selling.
Nice.
I think we as South Africans have got so many problems to deal with all the time. I feel like our load has been lightened recently with load shedding not really being a thing this year.
Touch wood.
Our elections, I think, going as good as they could have gone.
Yeah.
Possibly ever. In any scenario, if I was Doctor Strange counting all the different ways in which the election, this is the one where I put up my finger to say this is the one way that I think this all could have worked out.
Which is also kind of depressing.
Sure. But what The Showerhead is it's a documentary all about the relationship between Jonathan Shapiro, who we know as Zapiro, who is a very famous cartoonist. So he writes, he draws sort of often quite single frame political cartoons that have existed in Sunday Times over the years and Daily Maverick, commenting on our world in South Africa. And so he's probably one of the country's sort of national treasures, right? One of the people that certainly helped us make sense and understand the craziness.
Mm.
But what I'm saying is that in South Africa, we are so focused on our everyday struggles that we forget what happened yesterday.
Yeah.
We forget what happened last month. We forget what happened a few years ago. And this film, if it does one solid favor and contribution, It's that it reminds you of the story of Jacob Zuma.
Right.
That's good.
So
yeah.
The film is called The Showerhead, and it's all about the little shower that was put on the head of Zuma by Zapiro.
Yeah.
Because you forget that before Jacob Zuma was in power for a good fucking 8 years in this country, there was an incredible amount of controversy behind him.
Yeah.
He went into his presidency with 700 charges against him. Do you know what I mean? Like, we could have some sort of fucked up scenarios and have like a charge or two, or there was that speeding fine, or I got arrested for being a bit drunk.
Yeah, he's out. You know, Trump.
It's like one or two. 700.
It's fucking crazy. I remember that.
And then the wildest part, which completely undermines South Africa, was that they were all very conveniently put aside.
Yes.
Yeah. So that he could be president.
Yeah.
So it's like, let's not forget that happened, which is worse.
Yeah.
So, but there was this moment in history where he was found having this sexual relations with this woman, which later got from her side said as rape.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so there was a rape charge. And in the testimony of it, he said that he was aware that she had HIV.
Right.
And that it was okay because he took a shower
like
afterwards.
Cold shower,
to reduce his risks of it. And this is all just ridiculous because he was the head of our moral...
Yeah.
Whatever committee at the time, which is just preposterous.
Yeah.
And so this shower head got put on his character.
Yeah.
And whenever he appeared, he had this shower head. And so this film is really just about that presidency, going into it that time, and just a reminder of what happened.
Yeah.
Structurally and as a documentary, it doesn't blow you away. It's quite a lot of talking heads. So I don't think anyone can expect a super refreshing, game changing, exciting documentary in that form. But just by simply telling the story,
It's like a time capsule. Almost,
it's a time capsule, and you've got these documents, which is so cool.
Mm.
It's lovely having the documents, not just guys just talking, but there were these particular ones. The most famous of which was the rape of Lady Justice.
I remember that.
Remember seeing that particular frame,
yeah,
a particular cartoon, and it shocked us.
Yeah,
and just the ramifications of it, and how Zuma was trying to sue him.
Yeah.
At parts of the of his career, you know, what president is going to stoop so low to sue a cartoonist?
Yes.
You know? And what does that say about freedom of expression? And you know,
sure.
but then he also didn't pursue it. He just sort of did it to fuck with him. Oh, very interesting.
Yeah.
But it's lovely to get that reminder. So The Showerhead is coming to cinemas and will be at the Bioscope.
Nice.
From the 13th. So yeah, when this episode comes out this coming Friday.
Mm. Amazing. Cool. Sounds good.
Any other films? Should we move on to TV shows?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. The big show that everyone is binging is The Perfect Couple, which is on Netflix. And it is lekker. As I said, it is set in the Nantucket.
Russell's stamp of approval.
Yeah, it gets the lekker stamp. It is one of those juicy whodunit.
Oh, sick. I love those.
Sort of crime drama. It's not so much a thriller, but it's akin to the sort of Agatha Christie's we all know.
I love that.
You know, there's an ensemble cast. Someone dies. It should be someone in this room who did it.
Right.
So it all centers around a marriage. So our main character is marrying into this very wealthy family.
Okay.
I think if you're wealthy, like, you know, the Hamptons, New England, Nantucket. It's serious money. It's like fucking private jet money.
Yeah.
And so she's marrying into that. The matriarch of this family is played by Nicole Kidman.
Okay.
Who is an author of books. So the book itself, The Perfect Couple, was written by a woman called Ellen Hildebrands.
Okay.
And her books are very much these kind of crime romances all set in New England. So she's very much kind of writing herself into this particular book, The Perfect Couple. So Nicole Kidman's character is this author, quite a famous, relatively well-known author.
Okay.
Her husband in the story is Liev Schreiber.
Oh, cool.
I love Liev Schreiber.
And he plays a guy called Tag. But also Tag. Just wealthy. It's his family that's got this money. And the first episode is the rehearsal dinner.
Okay.
Where all the characters are arriving for this weekend wedding. One of which is a very attractive, very sassy maid of honor who seems to have some backstory and involvement with everyone else. And you can tell from the looks that there's connections. And she dies. So it's quite cool in the first episode. You don't know who the person is who's died. It's got a little bit of a White Lotus-y-ness to it. So I don't want to give more away than this.
Yeah.
But for the first episode, you're left wondering who the person is who's died. But then you come to know the real juice of the story is the fact that this maid of honor's died.
Right.
They find her on the morning of the wedding.
Ah.
Jeez, okay.
And so there's a lot that's happened and plays out. And it's all set amongst this like incredible wealth and secrets. And it's just the good, juicy... whodunit sort of set amongst this kind of wealth and this beautiful, beautiful countryside. The Perfect Couple.
Fun.
It's a good 6 episodes. I think it's this is TV at its best for me.
Oh, wow.
You know, where you just get like a good story.
Yes.
Good characters that would make the movie would be wrong.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? The movie would have to compromise.
Yes.
And it also shouldn't be a 24-part series that gets seasons and seasons.
Mm, right.
This is the perfect optimization of a good, juicy book is a limited series. We know this.
Yeah.
Harlan Coben is the similar author, and he got a 10-picture deal with Netflix.
Jesus.
Where you just need more time to get into the backstories and the nuance and the relationship between this character and this character. And And then the detectives who are coming in to solve this are also very interesting decisions.
Cool.
You've got the local sheriff, the local detective, who's somewhat compromised because these wealthy families contribute so much to their police service.
Right.
But they also know that they're fucking corrupt and a little fucked up and have their secrets. But we've got this outsider character who's like a state detective who has to sort of travel to this little town to see this murder mystery through.
Okay.
But she's quite a unattractive, sort of no makeup, sort of quite frumpy lady.
Right.
Who also is a very interesting character. And it's so nice because she feels very much as an outsider because all the women in this show are all these sort of beautiful manicured women and all the men are these sort of handsome, wealthy guys that dress perfectly. And so it's quite cool that this kind of this sort of outsider comes in. So she's also a very interesting character.
Nice.
But The Perfect Couple.
Cool.
On Netflix. Man. And it's we were on course to finish it.
Okay.
So I'm 2 episodes away. But it's like it's the perfect weekend binge. Like you'll smash it in 2 days.
Okay, amazing. Cool. I'm keen to give it a shot.
No, it's cool. I mean it's
love that kind of stuff,
It's certainly not changing the landscape, but it's just good, well written.
That's nice. Good, man. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Drama.
Yeah.
So
Nice.
Anyone else?
Me and Kira have been knee deep in Below Deck Mediterranean's new season. We're loving that.
Okay, Below Deck is the reality show about
On Bravo,
about deckhands working in the yachts.
Yeah, right. Deckies is what we call them. They work on these multi-million dollar yachts and they just work with terrible clients and amazing clients and there's drama. Everyone's sleeping with each other. Everyone's drinking. Oh, it's so good.
There's often South Africans
in the
show.
There's often South Africans and they often disappoint me.
Oh, why do they disappoint you?
No, they often are just such dickheads. Right. Like... Deckheads. No, they. Oh, Jesus.
I think when you're 19, There's yeah. certain things that you can do in the world, right? Yeah. And yeah. so South Africans know that they can travel
yes.
to parts of the world to sort of do the sort of 19, 20-year-old jobs.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think if you're like bookish and smart, you perhaps gravitate, and if you love anime,
yeah.
you gravitate to the teaching Asians English.
Yeah,
it's so true.
Job.
Yeah.
But I think if you're like there for a good time
yeah.
and are like...
You feel
attractive yourself,
yeah.
then that might appeal to you because you get to spend a lot of time in the med.
There's big bucks right. as all your.
And if you're aware that the more attractive you are, you might get more tips.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you would gravitate to like bartender
yeah.
and be in more hospitality.
Yeah.
And then the yacht hands, provided you don't get completely motion sick.
Yeah. It's definitely
a job. And so you can imagine that probably people who did seasons of yachting were yeah. like, this would make a great show.
Yeah.
And so they did it.
Yeah,
so
like the good movies to watch with paired up with Below Deck is like Triangle of Sadness.
I was about to say.
It's identical. It's yeah. so good. And then there was a great little French movie that came out 2-3 years ago called Zero Fucks Given. And it's about it's about air hostesses, and it's a drama. But also the whole thing in that movie is she is trying to get work in certain places. But the first question they always ask is, "Are you attractive? Send us body shots." Like yeah. you know, right. because it's a service industry, but it's a service industry where looks is more important than anything else. You know what yeah. I mean?
Right. And sometimes it's a yeah. certain look.
Yeah,
I know that friends of mine. Were considering jobs at like American Apparel, which was like a very particular kind of store in America. I don't think it really exists anymore, but it was like...
It's like a brand.
It's like you had to be like attractive, but you could be like a redhead with nose piercings. Yeah. Like it wasn't a perfect look, but you had to have a look.
Yeah.
And you were very much picked on whether or not that worked.
Yeah.
Right.
Fit the bill. Yeah.
Interesting.
But yeah.
No, whatever those deckhands get paid...
Yeah.
Is what I would personally pay to not do that job. Because, like, the hot Mediterranean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I am a motion sick person.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, I would do anything to not have that job.
Yeah, but it's we're having good fun with it. Yeah, it's the cast. I'm okay with the cast. I love the Chief Stew. Aisha, she's the best.
Are there certain characters that come back each
sometimes,
season?
Yeah. If they're really popular, they usually bring them back. So there's like five iterations of Below Deck. There's Below Deck Med, Below Deck Regular, Below Deck Light. Below Deck Norway, Down Under, and there's Sailing Yacht. Sailing Yacht's my favorite, but because they had the best characters, but they disappointed me in the last season, and it's changed how I look
but
at them.
But
now.
What is it that charms you? Because for those who follow the video store, they'll know that Perrin is tends to be like a darker horror person, seeking out sort of more nuanced stuff.
I just like, so I...
Is it the silliness of it?
It's the
lightness of it?
The thing is, it's the lightness of it. I mean, recently I've been going through a kick of just watching lighter things because I enjoy things where I don't need to think too heavily on. You know, just popcorn, something I can watch while eating.
Yeah,
right.
Because I don't want to watch a Lars von Trier movie while eating.
No, you know? Kinds of Kindness, if you're not looking up, you're going to miss
exactly. You know, so like with Below Deck, I'm just getting sometimes assholes, sometimes amazing people, just making my day good, you know?
Lovely.
Yeah.
Speaking of making your day good and fun, I was quite quick to say yes to the new Adam Sandler.
Okay. Oh, cool.
So this is the new Netflix comedy special of his. It's very interesting. Has anyone watched it?
No.
Okay, it's called Love You.
Right.
And it starts with this kind of, you know, I think it's worth mentioning that, you know, we get a lot of comedy specials.
Yeah.
And especially Netflix have put up their hand to say, we'll be the comedy special place.
Mm.
We'll be a home for comedians in terms of our television platform.
Yeah.
And then you can imagine every comedian going, well, how do I make my special a little different?
Yes.
And that's usually in the beginning and the end of their set. It gets filmed as like a little mini movie or a little walk-on or a little interesting vignette at the start or the beginning, or perhaps it's a form thing. So What's the dude from Parks and Rec, the Indian bro?
Aziz Ansari.
Aziz Ansari did one with Spike Jones. So they often like bring in these credible directors to give this kind of auteur stamp on it.
Yes.
So Aziz Ansari's one had a very close camera, almost as if this cameraman was sort of on stage with him. But anyway, so Love You was directed by Josh Safdie, who was one of the Safdie brothers who did Uncut Gems with Adam Sandler. Mm. And so it's really interesting that this movie starts with everything going wrong.
Yeah.
And it's this kind of anxiety beginning start. And even the screens in the show don't work.
Right.
And they make jokes about it. And he's like talking to crew about why aren't we getting the stage show? And you sort of wonder, like, what is this going to be?
Yes.
Why would they include this? This is Adam Sandler at still, you could argue, one of the heights of his career. Like, he's not slipping.
Yes.
So it's worthwhile watching how it kind of changes and what happens in the show.
Okay.
But funny, and it's Adam Sandler being Adam Sandler, which are these really quick, like, little jokey songs.
Yes.
But yeah, it's worth watching just to sort of understand what they were trying to decide.
Go for, yeah.
Right.
So yeah. I Love You, or Love You, on Netflix.
Cool.
Which, it's an easy watch.
Okay.
It's 40 minutes.
All right.
It's fun, especially if you grew up on Adam Sandler.
Right.
It delivers.
Have you ever seen a Billy Crystal stand-up special called 700 Sundays?
No.
I'm not someone who finds Billy Crystal particularly funny, but he did what's kind of an autobiographical stand-up show that kind of tells the story of his life. It's called 700 Sundays because he kind of figured out that's how many days he got with his dad, because his father died when he was quite young, and his father was only home on Sundays. He worked like six days a week, so he always had his dad on Sundays, and he had 700 Sundays.
You see, rooting it in something heartfelt. And so the previous Adam Sandler special,
yes,
what was the shining moment was when he did the song about Chris Farley.
Okay.
And it had some moments of fun in it, but it was more just like an emotional tentpole that kind of underpinned the 40 minutes of kind of silly jokes.
Yes.
It sort of gave it some heart.
Right.
And so he does the same thing here in Love You, and it is just sort of a celebration of comedy.
Okay.
And that's when the technology of this room works.
Right.
So it's almost like they made this decision to make things break in the beginning.
Yeah.
And things are awkward, and it almost looks like his life's falling apart in the beginning.
Right.
And then it ends with everything sort of coming back.
Okay.
So it's an interesting decision, because if you only were to watch the half, you'd think, shit, his career is going down the tubes if they can't even get a screen to work at the show he's performing at. So, yeah.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Good day.
Yeah.
Good day here at the video store. Yeah. Thanks, boys.
Yeah, thanks, man.
No, it was a nice chat. Yes. Our home base is the video store. .co.za. And so, yeah. Thanks for hanging out with us.
Nice.
It was nice having the three of you.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
And Lekker. We'll see you soon.
Yeah, bye,
see you
bye.
Soon. Bye. Bye. Bye.